I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, we present the second in a series of community panels called We Marched, We Rallied, Now What?, co-presented by the Women's March of San Francisco. Today's panel features representatives from various women's organizations to discuss the challenges they face during the new administration, including Claire Winterton from Global Fund for Women, Rebecca Griffin from NARAL Pro-Choice California, Amy Whelan from National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Lourdes Martinez from Mujeres Unidas y Activas. The moderator is legislative aide to San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell, Kanishka Kirunaratna, who will introduce our panelists.
Hi, welcome. This is the second in their series of We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? And so tonight, these advocacy organizations' representatives are going to be talking mostly about women's rights. That's the theme for tonight. Well, let me tell you first a little bit about everybody on the panel here. So we have Claire. Claire is with the Global Fund for Women. She led the International Museum of Women for 5 years as the executive director. And then that museum's merger with Global Fund for Women to create a new force for awareness and action on women's human rights. Claire combines a deep commitment to social justice with a passion for culture, media, and the arts. She's been a regular contributor to the Huffington Post on women's rights and popular culture. And then we have Rebecca Griffin. She is the associate director for NARAL Pro-Choice in California. She spearheads their proactive legislative campaigns, communications, and cultural organizing. She's leading efforts to pass proactive pro-choice policy at the local and state level, and partnerships with comedians to use humor to remove stigma and engage new activists in the fight for reproductive freedom. We also have Amy. Amy Whelan, senior attorney for the National Center for Lesbian Rights. She's been a senior staff attorney at the National Center for Lesbian Rights since 2011. She works on their full range of litigation policy and public education work. She litigates complex civil cases around the country regarding marriage equity, employment, discrimination, Title IX, family law, access to health care, prisoners' civil rights, the First Amendment, and a variety of other constitutional matters. And finally, we have Lourdes Martinez, political director of Mujeres Unidas y Activas. She has years of experience working with several immigrant communities in the Bay Area and the Central Valley of California as a lawyer and legal trainer with the Immigrant Legal Resource Center before coming to Mujeres Unidas y Activas. She's also worked as an immigrant attorney at the Interior Justice Center in the D.C. area, representing immigrant women fleeing gender-based violence. With that background of everybody here, if you guys could all just, we'll go down the line and maybe tell us a little bit about your organization's work and maybe your biggest activist focus under the Trump administration.
Thank you, and thank you, everybody. We are very, very happy to be here on this panel. MUA, Mujeres Unidas y Activas, we go by MUA, which is kind of nice. It's like a kiss, MUA. We focus on developing the leadership of immigrant women, Latina immigrant women specifically, in order to achieve within each of us personal transformation so that we can then work collectively, in the pursuit of justice. So with the belief that with all of the struggles that we face as immigrants, it is very difficult to come to, a social justice fight without first undergoing through a personal transformation that involves political education, healing from trauma, et cetera. So we have a dual mission that focuses on the individual, our internal self, and then on our collective fight for justice. So with that, under the Trump administration, one of the things that has been huge for us is having to shift our focus. We had spent over a decade working to promote the rights of domestic workers, to form the National Alliance of Domestic Workers, because, as some of you may know, domestic workers are one of those labor forces that is not allowed to form labor unions. So this had been the work of MUA for so long, and we also helped to found the state coalition for domestic workers and finally fought to win the the Domestic Worker Bill of Rights last year passed by the California legislature. And all of a sudden, Trump is elected, and we see ourselves unable to speak to the media out of fear, not knowing what our message really is or how to participate, feeling like the target of a very, not just an attack in rhetoric of racism and hate, but then also a real risk of deportation and harm to our families. So we've been having to do a lot of balancing our work of healing and just processing what's going on in our meetings with our membership. We're a community-based organization, so we have member meetings every day. And balancing that with, so what does our political work look like now? And what role can we play? And we'll talk about it, I'm sure, some more, but, you know, in what's going on at the state level, at the local level, with this issue of sanctuary jurisdictions protection from deportation. We've been engaged in forming the rapid response networks in San Francisco and in the East Bay, particularly in Alameda County. We really kind of led that effort. And so we've been focusing on immigrant defense work, which is kind of new for us, but it's been such a priority.
Great. Claire, would you like to tell us about the Global Fund for Women?
Sure. So Global Fund for Women is a 30-year-old organization founded in the Bay Area by women who believed really passionately that the way that you would see change in local communities anywhere, but particularly developing communities in the Global South, was if you invested in the ideas and the energy and the passion of women who were in closest proximity to the issues. So it's always been very focused on this idea that women at the grassroots understand their local conditions the best, and they're the ones who can engender change in their societies. And the work that we do is grant-making work to get financial resources to grassroots, locally-based human rights organizations, as well as awareness-raising work. We focus on three primary areas: sexual and reproductive health and rights, freedom from violence, and economic and political empowerment. And the groups that we work with often are groups that are highly marginalized in their own communities for different reasons. Women, maybe younger women, women who can't get access to other financial resources. And often and increasingly operating in a climate where organizing, civil society organizing, is being clamped down on in many countries. Increasingly, conservative and fundamentalist governments are making the landscape for women's rights very difficult. I think in many countries where there had been an escalation and an increase in women's rights, actually we're starting to see erosion. So, you know, in many various countries, and even before the shift in administration in the US, whether it's the erosions in women's rights that we've seen in Brazil, or the you know, attacks on women rights activists in Egypt, you know, the challenges that LGBTQI women are facing in Eastern Europe, there are serious threats in the landscape for women's rights organizing globally. And I think the challenge that we've seen since the shift in US administration is just compounding all of that and making those rights even more fragile, because we're very conscious that there is a significant ripple effect from what happens in the United States, both in terms of policy and funding, but also stance and rhetoric that really makes a difference for how women are accessing and experiencing their rights in different parts of the world. And I'm sure we'll talk some more about some of those different dimensions later in this discussion. But, you know, one example would be the new administration's reinstitution of something called the Global Gag Rule, that means that any organization overseas that is receiving US government funding is prohibited from counseling or informing women about access to abortion. So not even like not funding abortions, but using other funding not from the US government to even inform women about access to abortion. And this is something that's been affecting previous administrations, and the evidence is that it has a really significant chilling effect on every facet of women's health and rights. So whether it be, you know, not just understanding where there is access to safe and legal abortion, but access to contraception, comprehensive health care, HIV and AIDS funding, you know, many dimensions are compromised. And we see similar challenges in terms of the impact of the new administration on women in conflict situations, the safety and security of women human rights activists, the further compounding of the impacts of climate change, which impact women disproportionately. So myriad dimensions that are impacted. But at the same time, and again, as I hope we'll have a chance to speak a little bit more about, we're also seeing the positive in the sense that there is a huge resurgence in organizing. You know, more young women are organizing, more women are being pulled into feminist organizing of different kinds. There is, you know, a really resurgent movement in many places. And I actually was sharing just this evening that I was in Beirut about a month ago, and the women's march in Beirut actually started to heal a very fractured women's movement in Lebanon, and they're starting to come together and work together as women's rights organizations in a way that they haven't for years. So I think there's a lot of positives that hopefully we can start to find some courage in while we also confront the very serious challenges.
Great. Rebecca.
Oh, thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. How many people here have heard some version of this idea that abortion is the most divisive issue in this country and we're split like 50-50 and we have to be very careful in how we talk about it? A lot of you, yeah. So one thing that I really want people to take away from tonight is that just is not true. That as pro-choice people, we are the majority in this country, and that's really important in terms of informing the organizing that we're doing. And, you know, that's one of those media myths that's out there, and at NARAL, we really felt like it wasn't true, and so we tested it, and we changed the way we're asking people this question. And what we found is actually that a solid 7 in 10 Americans support access to abortion care. And that's true in Kansas. It's true in Florida. We tested it all across the board. And, you know, and that's really important in terms of thinking about how we talk about these issues moving forward. And I think as we think about, you know, the election as a turning point where we rethought our organizing, that there are a lot of things we can say about what this election was, but I don't think anyone is saying that it was a referendum on reproductive freedom. That if people had thought attacking Hillary Clinton on this issue was going to be effective, they would have done it. And that's really not what we saw. And so at NARAL, Pro-Choice America, our role is really organizing and mobilizing that 7 in 10 pro-choice Americans to support pro-choice policies at the state, local, and federal level, to elect pro-choice candidates. And, you know, I think that we're really at a crossroads right now in terms of thinking about what are the fights that we're going to take on as a movement. You know, what do we do with all this energy that's there that like Claire was just talking about? You know, our membership has increased by 20% just since the election. There's a lot of energy and, you know, figuring out the best things that we can do with it. In terms of some of the challenges, I think everyone here knows about a lot of the challenges we face from anti-choice politicians, whether it's this Trump care bill that defunds Planned Parenthood, if it's, you know, appointing anti-choice justices to the Supreme Court with another appointment possible in the future. You know, we've seen this administration embrace this very dangerous idea of religious freedom as a license to discriminate against women, against LGBT people. So and, you know, on the state level, a lot of people have been emboldened in their anti-choice attacks. So obviously that's something that we have to think about of where can we fight back? Where can we win? But also I think it's a really important moment for the integrity of our movement and how intersectional we are. I have seen so many opinion pieces in the last few months that are saying that feminists need to accept anti-choice people, that progressives need to accept anti-choice people, that Democrats need to loosen this idea that Democratic candidates should be pro-choice. Some of you might have seen NARAL was very involved in this fight around the DNC supporting an anti-choice candidate in Nebraska. And this was not a candidate who just personally had these feelings about abortion. This was someone who sponsored a 20-week abortion ban, who supported other legislation that, you know, was designed to shame and punish women for access abortion care. And I think this is a really critical time for us to be very clear that we are not going to get thrown under the bus by anyone in this movement. Thank you. And, you know, because this is not just a social issue that can be brushed aside, right? This is about our survival. This is the fundamental piece of our economic security and our ability to determine the direction of our own lives. And these changes, these attacks on reproductive rights, they're going to affect especially low-income communities, communities of color, and it's really devastating to, you know, their entire framework and their ability to support themselves and their families. So I think that, you know, we'll talk more about specific actions and some of what we're doing both here and nationally. But I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind is that, you know, we know that women have been fueling this resistance, that we've been marching, we've been doing most of the calls. And so it's really important in that as we're moving forward, that we're keeping in mind that both that we're the majority and that we're going to not back down in terms of being represented both by pressuring our enemies and pressuring our friends as well.
Great. I mean, you totally took the question that I had for you, so we could definitely talk more about that. So, Amy.
Hi, everyone. My name is Amy Whalen. I'm a senior staff attorney at the National Center for Lesbian Rights. We are about to have our 40th anniversary, so we've been around since 1977. And we were kind of born out of this feminist mission where our founders recognized that the LGBTQ movement at the time wasn't protecting women who were losing custody of their kids. And so we started taking on those kinds of cases, and we started taking on employment discrimination cases. And we were really born out of that feminist mission. And in the last 40 years, we have greatly expanded that mission, and we represent LGBT people all over the country and in a wide variety of contexts. So we have a sports project where we, for instance, work to try to get trans-inclusive policies in athletic associations across the country. We have an asylum and immigration project where we actually represent asylum seekers in this country who have been persecuted in their countries of origin. We have a transgender employment project. We have a family law project, which has continued our work of protecting family rights, protecting LGBT families, ensuring one of the Supreme Court marriage cases was our case out of Tennessee and the Sixth Circuit. And so we litigated that case. And since that time, we've seen a renewed attack on marriage-related benefits for LGBT people, related to pension benefits, related to health insurance, related to just marriages being recognized at all. So that's one shift. So I think it's a really interesting time for the LGBT community, I think, because in many ways, our experience under the Obama administration was unique. You know, if you look at all of our presidents throughout our history, there is not a president who comes even remotely close to second place in terms of supporting LGBT people. So we went from having the best president in history for LGBT rights, who not only was sort of tolerating the LGBT community or, you know, not seeking to harm us, but actually affirmatively, you know, instructing his agencies to figure out ways that our community can be protected, that legislation could pass on our behalf, that executive orders were utilized in our favor. You know, we had a very intense working relationship with the Obama administration. And so this is very different. It's very different. But that said, it's not that different from where we have been historically. And so, you know, I think that we are poised to deal with this kind of administration and to address the kind of bias and animosity that comes from it. It's something that our movement has done for a long time, that certainly our movements generally have done for a long time. But that said, how has our work changed? I mean, we've definitely gone from, you know, seeking out every affirmative thing that we could maybe do to being to still doing that work, but also being in a reactive state. And so, you know, what executive orders is he signing that we want to challenge in court? what are the ways in which we can ensure that state legislatures are protecting LGBT people if we know that the federal government won't? You know, we've gone from, we basically have two branches of government against us. And the only one really left for the, you know, next at least 2 years is the judiciary. And we already have one Supreme Court nomination that is horrible for all of our communities. And so this next one is even more important. And so we really all have to be working together and thinking about how do we get those branches back and how do we ensure that the least possible damage is done during this time when we are regrouping and fighting tooth and nail to make sure that progress still happens even in the face of this administration.
You're listening to We Marched, We Rallied, Now What?, a community panel on women's rights, featuring Claire Winterton from Global Fund for Women, Rebecca Griffin from NARAL Pro-Choice California, Amy Whelan from National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Lourdes Martinez from Mujeres Unidas y Activas. They're joined in conversation by Kanishka Karunaratna on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So some of the common themes that I heard here were the focus specifically on reproductive rights, but also that these organizations have decades of experience fighting for these issues. And so we're not starting from zero. Like, we have some experience in how to fight these battles. But also that we have made a lot of progress and we have some ground. And now this fear of how do we not lose that ground? It's almost like we have to put on the back burner the idea of keep fighting for more and just try to keep maintain what we have. And this issue, Rebecca, you brought up about how the Democratic Party, there's these conversations publicly, even from, I think Nancy Pelosi even said this, that maybe we should consider not shutting out anti-choice Democratic candidates. And as you said, I looked up the stats, and it was 57% of Americans support abortion rights, 74% of Democrats. So it's not quite as split as the media would have us believe. So how do we hold on to that ground when even the Democratic Party, where we thought was a safe space on this issue, is starting to waver on it?
Mm-hmm. I think those numbers are probably even low that you're talking about, because, you know, one of the things that we do when we poll this question is we give people three options. So we say, you can pick, I think abortion is moral and it should be legal. And that's where you get your solid 50% that we're all used to hearing about. But then another choice is, I don't think abortion is right for myself or for my family, but I don't think the government should interfere with anyone else's choice. And that's where you pick up another 20%. And a lot of those people might not call themselves pro-choice, but that's essentially what they are. And if the Democratic Party has people, and they do have people, I mean, like a Joe Biden or a Tim Kaine or any of these people who say personally they might have some qualms about it, they're not going to turn that into legislative attacks on other people's choices. And so I think clarifying what that means, and I think that, you know, it's about being very vocal and being clear about, you know, holding them accountable for the choices that they're making and who we're going to be there for and who we're not going to be there for when it comes to, you know, the legislation and the elections, and being really clear about that. You know, and I think thinking about how we're inserting this into the conversation on other issues as well, and really making those links, because, you know, when we talk about something like the healthcare bill, there are a lot of problems with it. Defunding Planned Parenthood is one of them, and what that really means. And also, as a lot of you might know, the plan says that tax subsidies can't be used to purchase a plan that covers abortion care. Well, California law says every plan has to cover abortion care. So they're basically saying, sorry, California, you don't get any tax subsidies. And that's something that would be dealt with legally if this ever gets through, which hopefully we won't have to deal with. But, you know, we need to make sure that we're inserting this in those conversations and also connecting those dots about what this really means. And I think the other thing, and part of what our polling thing is about, is showing people that you can win on these issues and they're not going to hurt you. You know, because I think that's part of the thing that some of these people will say is, oh, well, we have to run someone like Keith Mello because there are, you know, some Democrats who aren't pro-choice. But Hillary Clinton won that county, right? Like, she was very outspoken on these issues. And so I think they're stuck in this very old way of thinking. And so I think part of it is demonstrating in our activism and demonstrating when we get our champions up there and hold up those examples for people of how this is actually going to help you, not hinder you in what you're doing.
Yeah, I think what you're saying about how we frame what abortion rights means, that it's you can have your personal choices, but are you going to legislate somebody else's choices? And that should really make some traction with the small government sort of conservative ideologues.
Yeah, and one of the things that we found, we tested a lot of messaging to like that middle 20% of people, and what they responded very well to was this idea of priorities, right?
Right.
Like, okay, I didn't elect you to spend a bunch of time attacking women's rights. Like, why don't you go create some jobs? Like, right. Why are you obsessed with abortion? And that was the word we use. Like, you are, and like, we tested a lot of ads in some of these different races. Is like, why is Scott Walker obsessed with abortion? All these different people. So, you know, that kind of framework we found has been really useful. And we did a similar ad against Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, who lost that Senate seat. And that ad, I don't have the metrics off the top of my head, but it outperformed what is normal for an ad like that. So we got very, very good response to that. So again, it's kind of building up that case that we can point to, because I think politicians are cautious a lot of times. They're nervous. They don't want to, you know, if there's like the path of least resistance, a lot of times they want to take it. And like, we need to show them that this is actually going to do you a lot of favors, and that when you stand up and are actually a champion, we will be there for you and we will help you win. But you have to, you know, meet us halfway.
Yeah. I think for a lot of politicians, it's also sort of a cheap and easy press hit, which is what politicians are after. You know, they get a story for proposing these crazy laws. And so sort of stopping the rewarding of that system, I think, is something that we can all play a role in by holding the media accountable as well on that. So Claire, you brought up the global gag order. That's, I think, been a really interesting issue that we hear about every now and then. So does this now put a huge burden on private funding? Or is it even if you get private funding, it sounds like you can't provide reproductive education and counseling?
So basically, this refers to any U.S. Funding for global healthcare, which is actually an expansion on the way that previous gag rules were affirmed, because many Republican presidents have instituted these rules. But under Trump, all global healthcare expenditure is subject to this rule, not just expenditure for reproductive health. So it's 15 times more funding that is kind of in the equation in this scenario. So is a serious amount of money. There are other governments, some of the European governments have pulled together a consortium called She Decides. Some of you may have heard of this, which is designed to counteract the potential risk to reproductive healthcare expenditure globally that is posed by the changes in the US administration. The current thinking is that that's not going to be enough to alleviate what has happened. So, you know, we're hoping that other funders and maybe sort of private and individual funders will step up too, but it's just such a massive funding amount. And when you compound that with the amount of money that's being pulled out of overseas development aid by the United States, like the declining funding for PEPFAR, which is the president's task force around HIV and AIDS, which many global healthcare advocates predict is going to have a hugely detrimental impact on rates of infection of HIV globally. I think you have a really worrying picture. And given the work that we do, which is around really grassroots women's rights groups, very small groups with very, very small budgets, these are the groups that are going to get squeezed the most at the end of the day, because if the funding pool reduces, you know, players who maybe weren't so, you know, who were getting other funding from the US government, they're going to be grappling for the remaining funding on the table, and it's the smaller organizations who will get dropped off the bottom.
Right. So I want to shift a little bit to sanctuary cities, and I think that people don't realize what a big women's issue that is, but one of the big benefits of having a sanctuary city policy is that it really protects women in domestic violence situations and domestic worker situations from being able to report crimes and be witnesses. And recently we saw in Texas, I believe, they passed a ban on sanctuary cities despite the opposition of the Texas Police Officers Association. So the law enforcement was unified against this ban, but the governor still signed it. And as we see this ban go forward, I think even in San Francisco and in the Bay Area, we're starting to see a decline in reporting of crimes. So if the Trump administration has been using the argument that immigrants are dangerous, and then they pass these sanctuary bans, and then we see a reduction in crimes being reported, it's almost like they're going to prove themselves correct. So how do we sort of get in front of that narrative?
Well, thanks for bringing this up. I think it's very important with what you mentioned about Texas. What's happening in California is that we have a sanctuary state law pending, and it's the Sheriff's Association that is working with the Department of Justice and the Trump administration to push for to kill the bill. You know, they don't even want to amend it. They just want to kill the bill in California. And the primary... the primary message that they use to support their argument is public safety, precisely depicting immigrants as criminals, which, as we know from studying so many events in history that involve persecution, I mean, this is it. This is how it gets done. You know, you convince the population that the group that you're targeting is dangerous. And so I think it's very important that we really open our hearts and consider that public safety is, you know, what is public safety? It's safety of the public. And if we are in California, the public is foreign-born. I mean, a fourth of us are foreign-born. And so I think in terms of how do we combat this, let's make it our issue. You know, it's not the issue of the immigrant community. Right. It's not the issue of an enclave. It's our issue. So I really think that just by getting involved is a really good way, by calling our assembly members, because the California Values Act is what it's called. It was introduced in the Senate, and it passed the Senate. But now it's up for votes in the assembly coming up in the next session, hopefully in May. But so I think that that's something that we can do, speaking of how to engage, is let's support this piece of legislation. It is very much about women's rights. You're absolutely right with what you just brought up. I think immigrant women are so vulnerable to sexual assault, domestic violence, all of these gender-based violence, you know, crimes. And it is very difficult to not only to call the police when there's no trust for the police, because now there's a total erosion of the distinction between immigration police and, you know, police that protect you from violent crimes. But it's also very difficult when, and this is a more complex conversation, but when the police are now persecuting your community. So it is very difficult to call the police, for example, in a moment of domestic violence. And these are very common cases where you really just need somebody to intervene to prevent a potentially dangerous situation at the home. But now you have to evaluate that with what are my children going to eat if their father or their uncle or, you know, my oldest son gets detained. So these are impossible, analysis to go through in your mind. And so basically you just don't resort to the police. And that's how we end up with communities that they have a totally different and outside of the law way of resolving this kind of conflict, which is really dangerous. And it's bad for integration. So I think that that's one of the main ways that we can combat this, is to really make it our issue and not leave it to a community that is really suffering from disempowerment. Many of the immigrants that are affected by this are not able to vote themselves. They're not citizens, even though many of them are lawful residents in the U.S. They have visas, but they're not citizens. So it's really important. This is a key place for allies to step in. And one other thing that I want to add, and maybe it's another call to action, is that the concept of sanctuary, there's an organization in San Francisco called Hand in Hand, and they represent employers of domestic workers. And they came up with this idea, and they're promoting this manual that is it's an instructional manual to employers of domestic workers on how to create sanctuary homes. And I think that's another really important role that we can play to support, the sanctuary movement, is to, integrate it into our lives. So if there is any way in which you interact with people that you believe might be vulnerable to this kind of policy, it's really important just to stand up as an ally in that way, mm-hmm. you know, and to really embrace the language of sanctuary. I've seen it in several places, and like in San Jose, the mayor did not want to adopt the sanctuary label, saying that it would be misleading to the immigrant community. Because what can San Jose really do about preventing immigration police from coming into their city? They can't, you know, forbid them from coming in. But what that analysis is really missing, and the reason it sounds disingenuous from an immigrant rights perspective, is that it's really about a moral stance on an issue and about showing a community, a very vulnerable community, you know, that we've got your back, we're with you. So I think that that's another way that we can really help, is to not only see this as a political issue at very high levels, but to see how it applies in our lives, in our daily lives. So, for example, this manual that Hand in Hand produced, it talks to employers about, you know, if you know that your nanny is an immigrant, don't, like, ignore it, right. you know, acknowledge it, and really let her know that you... that you support the sanctuary home, that your home is a safe place for her. If you feel comfortable, let her know you can be somebody that she can call on when if something were to happen. This is another thing we're talking about with our membership and our community at large, is creating safety plans. And part of the reason safety plans are so important, it's not only so that if somebody gets detained by ICE, there is a plan in place in the home. It's also just to help people ease their fear, which is huge. One of the main things harming our membership right now, very few of them actually have been victims of detentions or deportations, although some of them have, and one of our members unfortunately lost her son when he was killed back in El Salvador after he was deported. So this does happen. However, that one case leads to such deep fear when Trump uses his rhetoric among everybody else. And children are going to school outing their parents as undocumented immigrants without knowing it, just because they're trying to ask of their teachers, like, what do I do if my parent gets taken, right. you know? And then the parents are all worried about that. So I think that we have to really appreciate that the psychological and emotional effect of having allies, of having people that will take the affirmative step of saying, hey, I know what's going on, and this is where I stand on this. It's huge, just to ease fear and to help the psychological damage that fear is causing, which from the perspective of our organization as a political action organization, the fear is also causing women who have worked so hard for so many years to find a voice and speak the voice. It's causing us to perhaps doubt using that voice. It's removing potentially new, very powerful female leaders from the political discourse, even at the local level. And so if we can just help support each other in those ways. And if I can just take one more minute to say that, you know, to add to that, one of the things I've learned by working with immigrant women for so many years in my own family of immigrant women is it's difficult sometimes, especially if we're talking about people who can't engage in deep conversations with us in English, or who perhaps we only see in their context as a nanny to our children or something like that, it's difficult to appreciate what remarkable women they are. I mean, every violation of women's rights that you hear about around the world, there are women resisting and fighting those by moving to the United States. There are women who have fought so hard to flee domestic violence, forced marriages, you know, all kinds of gender-based violence and other affronts on their humanity. And they come here, and when they come to a place like Mua and they're given an opportunity to develop this part of their humanity, their leadership, their voice, they are really remarkable, powerful people. And sometimes we don't see them that way because they're in a vulnerable condition. But it is really important to support their voice and their leadership. And that's another reason to adopt, I think, this concept of sanctuary, even in our relationships.
Yeah, I think now is the time that we need those voices more than ever.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features We Marched, We Rallied, Now What?, a community panel on women's rights with Claire Winterton from Global Fund for Women, Rebecca Griffin from NARAL Pro-Choice California, Amy Whelan from National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Lourdes Martinez from Mujeres Unidas y Activas. They're joined in conversation by Kanishka Karunaratna. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I heard two sort of action items there. One is to reach out to the people in your community that might be immigrants, that you want to offer them that assistance and that comfort to let them know that your home and your relationship can be a sanctuary for them. And then to help support the state effort to make California a sanctuary state. So you said that bill is in the assembly now?
That's right.
So our assembly members here in San Francisco are Chu and Ting, and you should reach out to their offices and let them know how you feel. And then broader in California, it's always helpful if you have friends or family that live in other districts in California outside of San Francisco to ask them to support by reaching out to their representatives as well, because usually our California representatives, our district representatives in San Francisco, are pretty in line with sanctuary city policies being from San Francisco. But the center of California and Orange County are much tougher areas. And so if you have friends or family living there, that's a great way to use your voice.
And if I can just add one little thing to that is that, as I was mentioning, the Sheriff's Association is they're leading the activism against the sanctuary law. And a very problematic aspect of this is that they are elected officials. But just to give you an example, because I don't know all the sheriffs, but the Alameda County Sheriff, Sheriff Ahern, has been on a post in elections for years and years. And so this is a sheriff that has demonstrated over and over that he's not really accountable to people because he has run on a post. So it's another really key moment for us to see the voice of allies, especially citizens who vote. You know, we really need those voices to say these sheriffs do not represent us when they talk about public safety, in wanting to pursue policies that will have a large part of our public in fear. But that message really needs to come from citizen community, English-speaking community, white Americans, you know, a much larger variety of people.
So sheriff is a very, you would say, a down-ballot race that most people don't even vote for. They don't even bother going that far down the ballot. And especially an incumbent is very, very difficult to unseat. So that's a great example of a race that you can get involved in and support without probably a ton of effort or energy, but just a little bit of support for a new sheriff would probably be a great effort and use of your time. We've talked about reproductive rights and immigrant rights. I want to talk about LGBT rights as well. So Amy, I understand that there's some new discussions about whether sex discrimination protections apply to LGBT people. Can you explain more of what that means?
Sure. So people have probably heard about the Gavin Grimm case, this transgender boy in a Virginia high school who was denied the right to use the boys' restroom. And so this case is, you know, it went up to the Supreme Court and now it's sent back down to the Fourth Circuit. But one of the reasons that that case is so important, not also, to talk about transgender issues, but is because it raises this issue of, do our existing laws protect LGBT people? So we have federal non-discrimination laws. We have Title VII, which protects us from employment discrimination. We have Title IX, which protects kids in school from discrimination. We have the Fair Housing Act, which prevents people from being discriminated against in their housing. But none of those federal laws specifically mention sexual orientation or gender identity. What they do mention is that you cannot discriminate against somebody based on sex. And so in the Gavin Grimm case, one of the issues is you know, is it discrimination under Title IX to tell a transgender kid that they cannot use a bathroom? Is it sex discrimination under Title IX to tell a transgender kid that they cannot use a bathroom that's consistent with their gender identity? And so why is this important? Because we here in California are lucky enough to live in a state where we also have state laws that protect us in these realms, that protect us in our jobs, that protect us in our schools, that protect us in our, if we are discriminated against for housing. We're lucky enough to live in a place where, you know, our legislators have specifically said, this includes gay people, this includes transgender people. But many people across the country don't live in states like that. And those states, those maps look very similar to the maps of, you know, who the blue states and the red states. And really, there really has not been much, like, basically there's sort of an understanding that most of the states that were going to pass those protections have kind of done it. There really haven't been a lot of new states that are passing these laws that specifically protect LGBT people. And so this is a big deal. And this, so there was a decision that came out from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. It was the very first federal court of appeals to say, this just came out 2 weeks ago, saying that it involved a professor, an adjunct professor at a community college in Indiana. She was fired because she was a lesbian. And this court of appeals said, if you discriminate against somebody because they are gay, that is sex discrimination. And so that is the first time that a federal appellate court has said that clearly. So this is an issue that will likely reach the Supreme Court in the next, it could reach it, you know, next session or in the next couple of years. And so the makeup of that court is essential to this issue. It's, you know, it's the difference between ensuring nationwide protections for LGBT people in these very core places that are part, you know, if someone loses their job, that is a huge economic, you know, problem for not just for themselves but for their families. And so this is a big deal, and it's an illustration of why the courts are so important at this particular moment in time, and why we really have to work hard to make sure that judges are informed about these issues and educated about them, and that we are continuing to win in this realm.
That's really interesting. I didn't understand that that's how, that was the point that we were arguing, that this was a sex discrimination issue. So how can people get involved to support those efforts?
I mean, you know, that is sort of hard, but it is true that I will tell you that the number of federal judges, even though the Obama administration was really thwarted in appointing judges to the federal judiciary, he also did appoint a lot of judges, and we are actually seeing the effect of that. I mean, it's a big deal. I mean, just taking the marriage equality cases as an example, although it really was bipartisan judges. You know, we had maybe 70 cases across the country, so multiple cases in each state. And, you know, we had Republican judges and Republican-appointed and Democratically-appointed judges saying, no, this is a violation of the Constitution for states not to allow gay people to marry or not to recognize those marriages that were performed somewhere else. So, you know, I think that it's a little bit of a disconnect in terms of being directly involved in this issue, but I do think that you can be involved at a community level to make sure, for instance, that the places where your kids go or where you go or where your friends go or your family members or your loved ones go, that those places are have inclusive policies that are protecting LGBT people and kids and families. And I think that having, you know, we need to get a Democratic president elected in this country because we need to keep having progressive judges appointed to the federal judiciary. I mean, it's just deeply, deeply essential.
as you said, the judiciary is the only branch you really have, and that's a result of all the hard work of the Obama administration.
Well, and I mean, it's also a reflection of how extreme the Trump administration is, right? I mean, because, you know, there are judges all over the country that are overturning the actions that he is taking. But yes.
Are there any other call to actions that you all would want to advocate for?
Sure. So I'm going to mention money. I think it's worth noting and remembering that women's rights organizations, activism, organizing is deeply underfunded in the United States and globally. I think any of the organizations represented here tonight, but any of those that you feel a personal affinity with, you know, they need money as well as activism. That's what sustains activism.
That's right.
And we know that this is a massive deficit. You know, there's also an infrastructure nationally in the United States of women's funds as well as globally of women's funds. You know, that is a funding mechanism that the feminist movement defined and built in order to infuse resources into women's rights organizations. So, I mean, like many things that I would want you to do, but I think as no one has kind of boldly put it on the table, I would just say, you know, think about your philanthropy and make sure that women's rights, whether domestically or internationally, focused on whatever issues really speak to you, is really a strong part of your personal giving.
Absolutely.
So one thing that I think is really important for us here in California is that while the world is crumbling around us, that we continue to push forward in a progressive direction, right? Is that we are a beacon of hope and pushing forward for what it can look like when the reproductive freedom movement has political power and we use that political power. But of course, we're also responding to the Trump administration and what we're doing. So we are sponsoring two bills in the California state legislature. One is the Reproductive Health Non-Discrimination Act. And what this does, we're working on it with California Latinas for Reproductive Justice and Assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez-Fletcher. And this says that employers cannot fire or otherwise punish workers for their private reproductive health choices. So whether it's using birth control, using IVF, some of you are probably saying, wait, what, isn't that illegal already? But there are a lot of cases that have slipped through the cracks. There was a woman named Terry James in San Diego who was working as a financial aid specialist for San Diego Christian College, and they found out she was pregnant and she wasn't married, and they fired her for that, essentially for having premarital sex. This would be closing those loopholes and putting California really at the forefront nationally in terms of cementing those protections, and especially where we are at a place where the Trump administration is embracing this idea that religious freedom means I can impose my beliefs on anyone I want to, and that's primarily where we're seeing this happen. So, you know, the faith voice has been really important in this and pushing back on the idea that there's this one definition of religious freedom as opposed to religious freedom meaning we get to decide according to our own morals and values what we do.
Right.
And also, you know, at this point, the Chamber of Commerce is opposing the bill. And one of the things that we're doing is we're training people. So we could train every person in this room to go out into your community. And we're asking small businesses to sign on in support of this legislation. We have over 100 already. So if any of you own a small business or if you're interested in getting trained to do that. And then we have a bill with Senator Hannah Beth Jackson to create a pro-choice license plate in California. You may know that a lot of states have anti-choice license plates, but not very many have pro-choice ones. Part of the reason why we're doing this now is that the funding that is raised from when people buy these license plates will go to a program that provides family planning services for low-income people in California. And the funding that comes from reimbursing providers for those services is a huge chunk of the budget for Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers that are seeing their funding threatened by the federal government. And right now, the federal government picks up 90% of the tab for that program. We are working with three different California-based women artists on potential designs. We're doing a press conference on Monday where we'll unveil them. You all can vote on which one you like the best. But the biggest thing on this is that to get a license plate made in California needs 7,500 paid orders before they'll make them. So as we're working to get through the legislature, you can definitely tell people to get on board with supporting this, but also we'll really need your help when we get into that phase, and we're building up a list now of people who are saying that they're interested in buying one when that time comes around.
And Amy, do you have anything else?
I mean, you know, I feel like this issue is so personal to everybody. I mean, I'm not ashamed to say, yes, donate to NCLR if you can, and we will take your money, and we can definitely use your money. But, you know, some people have money to give. Some people have time to give. Some people have, like, a great attitude to give. So I feel like it's so deeply personal that you just have to weigh how much time do I have, how much time in a week can I dedicate to this. Like, can I give money? And if so, yes, give it. Maybe find a national organization, and then maybe find a local organization. And even if you give really small donations, it really makes a difference. And I think run for office. I mean, the one thing that I have been so amazed by is the huge number of women and people of color who are running for office who never have. And I feel like that is a key to major change in this country. We need to stop accepting that we are going to be legislated by, you know, white conservative men. That is, it's not acceptable, and we need to rise up and take control of what is happening to us.
That's right. We have 13 white men in the Senate working on a health care bill right now. That's right.
Yeah. I just want to say a few more about, like, the fact that we are an example to the rest of the nation, California and San Francisco, to really not take it for granted, but to, like, take it all the way, you know? Because, for example, it's horrifying that the first state that passed a law about sanctuary at the whole level, it was against it. You know, it was Texas against it. Like, that wave is so strong right now. We just need to, like, not really celebrate you know, our liberal state until we instead, like, let's take on the challenge, the call to push it all the way and to bring it even more to the local level, because that's one of my big things being from a community based organization. Besides from really encouraging you to focus at the local level, because I really think we need you at the local level, both with your philanthropy and your time. Also, think of us as immigrant women, as women of color, when you need somebody, if you're a reporter, interview us. If you're an academic, you know, invite us to talk to your class. Whatever it is that you have as a tool to integrate us and to bring us into the conversation and to help us be visible, I think it's incredibly helpful. Because I was actually just sharing before tonight's panel that it's not something we talk a lot about, but I recently attended a media training where they taught us that in the 2016 election cycle, less than 26% of spokespeople on TV and media were women, you know? And so we kind of have to help each other out with that as well, just to be part of the movement. And sometimes we don't realize that we have ways of doing that for each other. We don't realize just how powerful we can be to uplift somebody else. So that's something I just wanted to share, because it's something we're very excited, like when we're invited to come talk at an event like this.
Thank you so much. I think with that, I want to thank everyone here for being present and being a part of coming out, coming into the community. And I want to thank all of you up on the stage so much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was We Marched, We Rallied, Now What? A community panel on women's rights, featuring Claire Winterton from Global Fund for Women, Rebecca Griffin from NARAL Pro-Choice California, Amy Whelan from National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Lourdes Martinez from Mujeres Unidas y Activas. They were joined in conversation by Kanishka Karunaratna. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espalet, Maya Finley, and Jake Gukowski. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.